Good afternoon to all listeners in Barbados, across the world, and certainly Caribbean people in the diaspora. It gives me great pleasure to bring the third segment of Mental Health Matters. And as I have always said, there are many mental health matters. In fact, I'm not so sure that we can cover this in 12 weeks, but that our individual and collective mental health matters. Last night, for example, I went dancing for my own mental health, and I had a great time. I wouldn't say where, but I had a great time. I want to thank Lewis Drug Mart in Rockley, Christchurch, David Lewis specifically, for agreeing to sponsor two programs. So thank you to David. And without further ado, I want to introduce my guest, lovely lady. She is Dr. Maisha Emmanuel. She is a lecturer in the Faculty of Medical Sciences at Cave Hill UE, the University of West Indies, and a consultant psychiatrist at the Queen Elizabeth Hospital here in Barbados. And she's held both posts for the last 17 years. Having said that, she looks like 25. She is also a member of the Barbados Association of Psychiatrists. And they begin, coincidentally, their week of activities this week, which she is at liberty to share with the public. Before I call on her to speak to that and to other matters, I need to say this to the public. Today's program focuses on a very serious subject, that of suicide. I have been encouraged by many to address it. And as host of this program, and also on Starcom Networks on behalf, I wish to issue what is known as a trigger warning for those who might be traumatized by this subject, whether directly or indirectly. So if you choose to change, you know, change channels, change radio stations, that's fine. But we have to address this topic. The Center for Disease Control states that suicide is death caused by injuring oneself with the intent to die. A suicide attempt is when someone harms themselves with any intent to end their life, but they do not die as a result of their actions. And it goes on to say that there are many factors that can increase risk for suicide, but also to protect against it. So Dr. Emmanuel, welcome. Thank you. You have vast experience. Suicide is a very sensitive matter. It is one that requires a lot of family support, psychiatric, psychological, many types of support. And we need to give people permission. I keep talking about this, especially living in a small society, for people to acknowledge the depth and the gravity of their mental illnesses or mental health challenges. What would you say are some of the signs and signals that would help us to identify when someone is in such a serious state and wants to end it all?
Well, thank you and good afternoon, everybody. Thank you, Tessa, for inviting me onto your show. And you're absolutely correct. It is a very sensitive topic, but as we, you know, I think it's because it is sensitive is why we need to talk about it and have that space and fora where you can have an open and honest conversation, specifically to answer the question you asked about how do you, you know, some of the warning signs of suicide. Well, something as straightforward as the person starts talking about suicide, where they say things, they may say, you know, I wish I were dead, or I wish I wasn't born, or what's my purpose? People who start to talk about being hopeless, well, what's the point? Where am I even going to try if whatever I've tried before has not worked or has failed? People start to change their behavior in terms of maybe being more withdrawn, isolating themselves more, becoming even more irritable than you would typically expect for that person. People may start using alcohol and other drugs in a manner, either they start using it for the first time or they start using it more than what would be their norm. You know, people would change their normal routines, like with eating and sleeping. So, you know, have somebody who is, who may, the more typical things that people eat less when they're feeling depressed, but some people do increase their eating, as well as people tend to sleep less when they're depressed, but again, people may increase how much they're sleeping. And I think it's important for us to make a distinction on somebody feeling depressed today because something bad happened this morning or yesterday, which is very different to somebody with what we would call a clinical depression, where there are a lot more other things we take into consideration. Because I don't want people listening to get the idea that because somebody's upset and crying, that means the risk of suicide is high. There are many more factors that we take into consideration when making that assessment, so that we make a clear distinction between feeling bad about something, which is normal, because we don't want every bad feeling become a you know, mental health disorder.
Right.
Many people feel bad about many things because bad things happen from time to time. But it's not everybody then who is going to go on to have a clinical depression or have a high risk of suicide.
As you were speaking, I was thinking, so is it possible for somebody to mask it all, to
Absolutely.
Be feeling, to be crumbling inside,
yeah,
but yet they're going to work, they're interacting with family, they're raising children, but they are, as I said, crumbling and feel crappy inside.
Yeah.
Is that but also is that, possible?
Yes. Is that not what we are taught? Like, you suck it up and get on with it, right? You get on with school or you get on with your work. Everybody has problems. Nobody wants to hear yours. So you just get on with it. And I think that, to me, is where we can start in terms of having a space for people to be able to express how they're feeling, recognizing that they will be offered support and not, oh, come on, man, this is just a simple thing, snap out of it, or it's all, you know, all the cliche things that people say to
yeah.
you. And I
yeah.
think in with public education, meaning, and I must talk about COVID here, because one thing COVID has done is allowed us that time and space to say, I don't feel good. This thing bothering me. I don't like being away from everybody else. I can't stay in this house. I'm going crazy in the house. You know, it gave us that permission, so to speak. So as miserable as COVID has been in a lot of ways, it has at least opened up when it comes to being able to talk about the way you feel. And I think that is going to be a tremendous step forward in how we manage mental health conditions going in the future.
Well, I'm so happy you said that, because I made that point last week with Dr. Harvey, that now more than ever, people are talking about my mental health. I need to do this for my mental health. I need to, you know, fraternize and socialize.
Yeah.
And we all want everybody to do that safely. Last night, I was in a large open space and I felt very safe, and we had to show our proof of vaccination.
Yeah. I think what COVID has allowed us to do, because we all know we get it a bit more than we did before. So in the past, unless you're going through some type of, you know, difficult situation, whether it's a job or partner or something like that, you don't really know what it, or you couldn't conceptualize what it actually felt like to be anxious or to be depressed and all those types of feelings. Yeah. Now you have something that has happened to all of us.
Right.
All of us, every country, nobody has been spared. So yeah. The feeling and the experience and the language is there that we can all relate to. And yeah. There's no stigma in saying, this is how I feel.
Yeah.
Because people still, as I'm sure everybody listening would know, people still joke about, you know, going down to Black Rock or seeing the psychiatrist or having a therapist. You know, you still hear it. But now with COVID, it has actually given us a level playing field where we all can relate in one way or the other to these emotional difficulties.
Or going to see my shrink. Yes. I hate to hear those words. Mm-hmm. Only last week, I heard from a friend, a very close friend of mine, and this incident occurred in Toronto. I don't even know this person's name, nor would I identify her. But she had just bought a home and she was just sitting in her living room surrounded by family members. And she walks to the, I guess it was a condo. She walks to the patio and jumps 10 floors down to her death. Mm. And everybody is just in shock.
Yeah.
So these things happen. But my next question is, what attempts are made by you in your capacity as a psychiatrist to support such an individual during that process of pain when they begin to have suicidal ideations and suicidal thoughts, and it's brought to your attention? In a lot of cases, families don't know how to navigate these issues.
Yeah, and that's one of the advantages of having a psychiatrist or psychologist or social worker, somebody with whom you feel comfortable and you know your information will be confidential, that person that you can talk to. Because patients or people will come and say to us things that they, as you're pointing out, probably would not say to their spouse or their families or friends and so on, right? So in our assessment of risk, we ask a number of questions. And again, that comes down to the person being open and honest and feeling comfortable enough to have that type of discussion. So we ask a lot of questions around the circumstances of when these thoughts started to happen, you know, any triggering events, whether they have support or not, whether they have a pre-existing mental health condition or not, you know, whether they have access to means by which to harm themselves. The point is, there is a spectrum of risk assessment, from low risk, where you have fleeting thoughts, meaning every now and again, the thought will pop into your mind, but you're able to ignore it and you can talk yourself down, all the way to the other side of the spectrum, where you are in the position where you have resigned your job, you've written your note, you've made all the preparations, and you have set a time and a date. Okay, so there's a wide range of risks, and we don't obviously admit everybody. Because, you know, when you think of how many people have fleeting thoughts of hurting themselves, if we were to admit everybody, we would run out of beds quite quickly. So we try to work with the person as in terms of identifying what their stressors are and doing things that would mitigate against that. When we start talking about admission, is if we determine that the person's risk to themselves is high. And it's only people who are high risk that we would admit. Sometimes, obviously, somebody is high risk and not wanting to come into hospital. And that's when we have to then involve family and so on to have the person come into hospital. But that is the minority of patients. Most people are managed outside of hospital.
Yeah.
And they don't need to have a hospital stay. Because I know a lot of times people are afraid. If I tell my psychiatrist how I'm feeling, they're going to lock me up. But as I'm saying, that is the overwhelming minority of people that we have to bring into hospital to manage their suicide risk.
Right. I wanted to ask you this, though, but when a suicidal person presents before you, whether male or female, given what has been going through, you know, with their thoughts, their ideations, their plans, are they generally in a position to tell you what the truth is? Or do you have to like probe and prod and, you know, because I can imagine that person not wanting to see you at all.
Yeah. One of the things we know is that asking somebody, you would think the opposite, but oftentimes when you ask, it's almost like relief. Like, oh, finally somebody is asking me this question directly and I can tell them how I feel. So yes, you're going to have people who are going to mask how they're feeling and not want to tell you. But for the most part, I found that people are quite relieved to talk about the thoughts that have been going through their mind and to get the reassurance that, you know, they are not alone, that there's help available, that there are multiple ways in which we can intervene to avoid things getting worse. And yeah. So again, the minority of people, you would have to probe and probe and probe, but the majority of people are actually quite happy in the sense of the relief that I'm talking about, to have somebody ask them directly, and then they're able to say, well, actually, yes, these are the things that I've been thinking about, this is what I've done and not done, and so on.
Okay. As you were speaking, and again, I find, you know, as the professional speaks, thoughts come to mind. Mm-hmm. What about self-mutilation? Mm-hmm. And how would you link the two? Because that it is self-harm.
Right.
For the public, right. Public's benefit.
Yeah. So
how would you link the two of them?
Right. So it's important to know that there's a difference between self-harm and suicide. Okay, one, self-harm may become suicide, but it is not always the person having an intent to die. So if I am distressed for whatever reason, and this, you know, something has been going on and I've been trying to get help and not getting help, and I take I use something to make very shallow cuts to my arm, or instead of taking two Panadols, I may take eight. And I'm thinking, I don't, it's not that I want to die, but I am expressing my distress in this way. So it's, we think of self-harm as a cry for help. So the person is saying, something is wrong. I want you to know that something is wrong. I don't have the words to express myself, so this is the way I'm going to let you know. That's very different to someone who is not, the intention is death. Because somebody who is taking a protractor and scraping their arm, they know they're not going to die from that. That's very different to someone who says, uses some other lethal method like Gramoxone or hang themselves or something like that. But obviously, there are different things, but as I said, one, self-harm can lead into suicide, because then if the behaviors become repeated, or you escalate, what we call escalation of the behavior, so it's no longer shallow cuts, it becomes deeper and it becomes in a specific area and all of that, then obviously the intention there becomes more and more and more. Okay, yeah. But why this is important is that a lot of times, especially with teenagers, their parents will present with the teenager and they're absolutely horrified that this child is, say, cutting themselves. And it's important to understand that there is a distinction, although, as I said, one can lead into the other one. So the difference there is in intent. What is it that you expect to happen after you've done this thing?
Yeah. Ronnie, just let me say, I don't know if you wish to promote Louis Drugmart during this program, you'll need to alert me, or whether we can just proceed.
We always look to acknowledge our sponsors, and you can do so at will during the program. And I'll do that right now with the compliments of Louis Drugmart in Rockley Christ Church. We are presenting Mental Health Matters.
Okay. So I know of an individual, for example, who cut her breast, mm-hmm. both breasts, with a piece of glass, as opposed to cutting her wrist. How would you respond to that in terms of the, you talked about a spectrum, mm-hmm. the severity of the problem, mm-hmm. but what was fascinating about that particular circumstance, the person often feels a sense of release, as macabre as it may sound.
Yeah. But when you speak to people who self-harm in that way, that is exactly what they say to you, that the emotional pain that they feel seems less after hurting themselves. The other way people say is that, as you said, the word release or relief. But the idea here is, how do you then help that person develop other ways of coping? Because that's what it is. It is a way of finding that emotional relief or release. For some people, cutting does that, but obviously you don't want a person to be hurting themselves to find that emotional outlet. So my role, and the role of other, you know, other therapists and social workers and so on who are trained in this subject, would be to help that person find coping skills that are helpful as opposed to hurtful. It's interesting you raise that issue of cutting, because cutting is the most common method people use to self-harm. People then also hit themselves, like banging your head or banging your face, and some people burn themselves, you know, the different things, but just cutting is the most common things. And some people, as this person that you mentioned, they do it where people can't see it. So whereas a lot of people, you would see it on their forearm or their arm, some people use their thighs. And in this case, this person is using her breast. But the point is, the bigger point is, this person is expressing a need for help because she's distressed for whatever number of reasons.
And it would not have been shown or seen easily.
Well, no.
Right.
Yeah, okay. Exactly.
Okay, my next question to you is it necessary in all cases, or how do you determine whether a suicidal patient should be institutionalized, whether at Ward C4 or at the Barbados Psychiatric Hospital? Some people even need to be restrained. So how do you or psychiatrists make that determination, or they have this family support, so we send them back home.
Right. So remember, I was saying earlier that there are a number of things that we look for in determining somebody's risk, and for the majority of people, the risk will not be high. But for the people with high risk factors, we know, for example, men, just by their sex of being male, that's a high risk factor. And the reason for that is that men tend to use more lethal methods. So men will more likely hang themselves or use a firearm or use gramoxone or, you know, something lethal like that compared to women. We know, for example, that in terms of age, there are two high risk age groups. So adolescents, young adults, that's one high risk group. And then older adults, that's another high risk group. So as I go through these high risk groups, the assessment is based on all of these factors. So gender is one, or I should say sex is one, age is one, the presence of a history of suicide, and that's the suicide attempt, I should say, that's the most important risk factor, because like with anything, you know, the cliche, practice makes perfect. So every time you hurt attempt to kill yourself, and then you survive, your chance of trying it again goes up. Okay. Mm-hmm. So the presence of a past history of a suicide attempt is predictive of another attempt. Okay. We also look at things like whether or not you have family support, whether or not you have a pre-existing mental health disorder. Substance use is a huge red flag, especially alcohol. We know that half of the suicides that occur, people would have been intoxicated at the time. And this is not necessarily to say that the person is known to misuse alcohol. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about at the moment when that person has decided that they're going to go through this, they tend to drink. And the reason for that, of course, is that you become disinhibited when you're drunk. So then you get, you are more likely then to carry out whatever plan you have in mind. So obviously it's not just the presence of suicidal thoughts that would say, okay, this is a high risk. There are all of these factors that we go through. Presence of a chronic illness that is painful or debilitating, for example, or something that's terminal.
You're saying like somebody who had, let's say, multiple myeloma, or somebody who has multiple sclerosis.
Right, exactly. Something that's debilitating, that's going to affect this person's function and so on. Now, I am just giving a list of some of the factors that we look for. I don't want people to think, oh, so-and-so has MS, that means they're able to, try to kill themselves. That's not how this works, right? It's a matter of just the things that you consider in total to decide whether somebody's risk is high or not.
Yeah. You mentioned a few key things, and I think for the benefit of the public, I just want to reiterate them. The question of gender, with men being more predominantly predisposed to suicide. Mm-hmm. I think we know all too well in Barbados that men are less likely than women to get help, generally.
They're less likely to seek help.
Seek help.
Yeah.
You mentioned two age cohorts, adolescents and young adults, and then older adults, the elderly as well. And you mentioned substance abuse, and specifically alcohol, which is, we will deal with that as we progress in this program. So I think those are very important, like markers, so to speak. During the COVID-19 pandemic, and as you said initially, there appears to be increasing rates of suicide. Among both men and women. Again, I don't want to highlight any specific individual because their family is involved. But what are your thoughts about this? Why is it increasing? We've had a range of age cohorts, a man in his 60s, a young woman, an elderly man, not elderly, but he was in his 60s. Why is this happening? Are we just too stressed out?
Well, I think there are a number of things we need to highlight there. First of all, Barbados in general has a low suicide rate. It's one of the lowest. I think we're the second lowest in the world at this point. So right now we are 0.6 per 100,000, right? So we're, out of nearly 200 countries in the world, we're very much near the bottom of that table. The other thing, before we can say that the rates are high during COVID, we need to first have the data to confirm that. And typically suicide data lags behind in terms of how it is collected. So because there's a newspaper article saying so-and-so was found at home, that is not how we decide if that is a case of suicide or not. So it usually takes a couple of years, and we do not have that data yet for COVID. So I think it's important that we don't just base what we think on anecdotal evidence. What I can say, though, is that definitely through COVID, we've seen a lot more people present with feeling stressed out, feeling anxious, feelings of depression. So we can anticipate that some of that will translate maybe into more suicide being completed. I think the world anticipated, though, that COVID will bring on higher rates. But as I said, we probably have to wait for a couple of years to get that data to be clear that this is what is actually happening. Because so far, when you look at world data, it has not shown that suicide rates have gone up. Right? So there are a number of different factors here. As I said, suicide is not, the data on suicide is not as straightforward as you would think. But to your point, people are definitely a lot more people presenting to clinics and psychiatrists and other mental health professionals feeling extremely stressed out, whether it's over finances, job insecurity, being cooped up at home. So for sure, that is happening.
Yeah, there's something in, I mean, you mentioned that where Barbados is concerned, it's lowest, low, very low, yeah, on the global spectrum. But having said that, there are countries like Guyana, where I have lived, and suicide is, and not meaning to offend any Guyanese, I don't know if it has to do with racial tension, mm-hmm, between blacks and whites. I don't know if it has to do with poverty. I know there's a high level of alcoholism, that much I know, even among the Amerindian community, bootleg alcohol being made. But I have read and been exposed to some gruesome suicides in Guyana.
Yeah. Guyana actually ranks number 2 in the world.
Wow.
Suriname is also within the top 10 in terms of the highest suicide rates. Trinidad also ranks high as well. And it's a stark difference to, you know, as I said, like us here in Barbados, Antigua, Grenada, and we all tend to be lower down on the list. Now, why that is so? Because you can ask, well, we are in the same region. You know, we share lots of things in common. Why is it then that you can have within the same region countries ranking near the top and others ranking at the bottom? And for the reasons that you raised just now about ethnicity, people talk sometimes about transgenerational conflict, and you know, people having different cultural backgrounds, and maybe that it may be related to that. These are theories. We still have to explore a bit more as to why these things are happening, but that they are happening is evident. And I think the question also is how can we identify the at-risk population and have interventions that would, you know, mitigate some of those risk factors?
It's startling that I mentioned Guyana and you said it was number one.
Number two.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Another question. And this is one of my pet peeves, one of my things that really upset me. Oftentimes when individuals with mental health challenges are in their greatest need for help, it is after hours, on weekends, during festive periods like Christmas. They don't necessarily want to socialize with family members. It's overwhelming. Easter crop over, whether it's reggae on the hill or jazz or soca on the hill, they are, as far as I know, there are no after hour services to cater to such people. How can we, or do you know of such? And if not, how can we change this? Because it happens at 2 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
4 o'clock in the morning on Kadumant Day, when I just can't be bothered to, I may have bought the costume, but I just don't have the motivation to go out there in the public space.
Yeah. So we do not have a dedicated suicide hotline, but what we do have are mental health services that are available 24/7, both at the psychiatric hospital as well as the Queen Elizabeth Hospital. So there are always psychiatrists who are on call. Typically, it's the consultant with a junior member of staff. And as you know, there's Ward C4 at the Queen Elizabeth Hospital, and the psychiatric hospital is there. So at 2 and 3 and 4 o'clock in the morning, although we do not have a suicide hotline, people can present themselves to the emergency department. And from there, the psychiatrist on call will be contacted, and that person will come to the emergency room to see patients there. Or they can go, people can go to the psychiatric hospital assessment unit, and then the person on call will meet them there. And on call is, there's always somebody on call. That's a basic requirement, like in any hospital. Okay. So there's always somebody available. In addition, there are a number of contact information that you can find, for, you know, domestic abuse, which is a 24-hour hotline. All of these numbers are on the GIS website. It's done up on the table so that you can, you know, print it off and keep it at hand, or have it on your phone, where you can contact any number of organizations via telephone. But in terms, it's specifically about out of hours, it's the emergency.
Right, because just, I've been in a situation where I had to help someone after hours, and I sat with that individual in A&E for far too long, to the point where the individual walked away after 5 hours. So, I mean, it might have been a day. And I don't mean to disrespect the Ministry of Health and the Minister of Health, certainly, but would I get through faster at the psychiatric hospital than I would at A&E? Because I am thinking of, you know, a family being in crisis, in panic mode, having seen somebody maybe tie a rope around his or her neck.
Yeah.
Where, how am I going to get, because my sole focus is getting help for this person.
Right. So at a psychiatric hospital, that's what the hospital is there for. They're only seeing people with in mental health crises at that hour in the morning. If you go to QEH, you're going to get every other thing. So every car accident, diabetic crisis, whatever. And so that's the difference, right? So in a situation like that, where you find that it's the wait has been long, then the psychiatric hospital is the option.
Okay. So there's always somebody on call.
Always, and
a psychiatrist.
Never close. No, exactly. The hospitals are not closed. They're always on call, people at both hospitals.
Yeah, that is very helpful. I'm also very mindful of the time, because we want to allow callers, but I have a few more questions. What advice would you give to families and to caregivers to prevent suicide? I mean, is it best to talk them through the feelings that they're experiencing, the ideations, or just to get medical help immediately?
Right, so I think the first step is talking, because unless you plan to you know, strap down the person and drag, which is not obviously what we want. So first point is talking to somebody about suicide does not plant the idea in their heads. And a lot of times people think, well, I'm not going to bring up that word because if I do, that will give the person the idea. That is, in fact, the opposite is true.
So it doesn't give, it doesn't give permission then.
It helps because, as I was saying earlier on in the program, you are relieved that finally you have an opportunity, somebody who's going to listen to you and understand what you're going to say and help you work through the issue. So I think talking and going back to what I was saying earlier about recognizing the signs and being able to have that conversation with the person, reassuring them that you're here, you know, you're going to be there to support them through it. This is not about punishment. It is about getting help, and you're there to support them and walk them through whatever the process is. And I think that's important, because if you start wrong, if the idea is that I'm going to trick you into, you know, people think, oh, we're going by so-and-so, and next thing you turn up in front of the psychiatric hospital, that is not helpful in the long run. Because it means the next time the person is in distress, they're just not going to tell you anything, because the last time, look at how you tricked them into getting care, right? Obviously, there are going to be times, and again, these are the few occasions, but there are going to be times when you're going to have to involuntarily have somebody admitted, meaning against their will, because you're so concerned about their risk to themselves.
To others.
And to others potentially as well. And there is a system in place for that by the psychiatric hospital, again, through the assessment unit, where the community nurse will come to the house or wherever the person is to make that assessment and then determine from there what's the next best step.
In terms of COVID and community, I've heard of community health nurses. Are they visiting families in this COVID environment?
Yes, the community nurses are visiting. One thing, as you know, the doctors and nurses and, you know, all the other medical staff, we continue to work through COVID and work more than usual. So yes, all of those community services are still.
They're all frontline workers.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Where suicide is concerned, and maybe you answered this already, but is it a process for the individual? I'm thinking about the individual whose thoughts are ruminating, who are focused on end of life. Is it a process for that individual to make that final step? Is it carefully, and I know this is generally, is it carefully thought through, or does it just happen suddenly, like that lady who walked, left her living room and jumped from her balcony 10 floors down?
Typically, people think and ruminate about death before they actually act on their thoughts. Okay, so of course you're going to have the exceptions to any rule. And if the suicidal thoughts are being driven by, say, psychotic symptoms, like, you know, hearing people talking to you and giving you commands, that may be a more seemingly acute thing versus somebody who is clinically depressed and having gone through weeks and months of feeling low and so on. So typically there are going to be warning signs going on before the person commits suicide, although oftentimes people say, I didn't realize or I didn't know, but things are happening that maybe the person was masking it, or people noticed a change but didn't think it was, you know, anything that was worthy. But usually there are things that are happening within the person before they decide to end their life.
Okay. My final question to you before we open up to callers, and I hope we will get many. In a perfect world, if we had a perfect world and money was not an issue, what types of services are needed in Barbados to cater more effectively and efficiently to such individuals? What would you want to see?
Yeah.
If you could wave out a magic wand.
Yeah. I think I wouldn't focus only, as we said, I think the whole mental health education is something that we need to focus on. And I think I would start with teaching children how to achieve good mental health. So before we start talking about illness and death, I think the important thing is, how do you maintain good health? And you made a comment at the top of the program, Tessa, about going out and having fun last night as part of your own mental health routine. And that is important. Diet is important. Exercise, you can't, you know, there's, you asked me about the magic wand, but there's no magic wand. It good mental and physical health always come back to the same types of things in terms of lifestyle. As they were saying, diet and exercise and balancing your stress in life, because there will always be stress, but how you cope with it, developing coping skills from early, and hence why I'm saying, you know, getting into schools, making it a normal thing to have checkups, you know, like how you go to your doctor for physical health, you should be going to have mental health checkups as well. And I think the emphasis is there in a perfect world, way before we start talking about, and of course you need services and all of that, but I think if we can get in early, then we would have less need of those types of services.
I would never forget, while I lived in Toronto in the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s, and of course being a developed city, I lived in Ontario. Staff of the organization where I worked, we were entitled to mental health breaks, mm-hmm. because I worked with the Black Coalition for AIDS Prevention, but we were entitled to take a mental health break. I don't know if such things exist in Barbados, but there were times when it was felt like, mm-hmm. you want to avoid burnout, yeah. and it was okay to ask for a mental health break.
Right. Well, I think in Barbados, we call those vacation days. We don't call
This was separate and apart from
vacation. I know, yeah.
Separate. Okay, so Ronnie, are there any callers?
Not yet, but there are some comments on the Facebook. Good afternoon, very interesting program. I enjoy listening. Mental health issues are real. And then there was a comment that says, Miss Chatterton Shaw, it's very good that you're speaking about going out and you enjoyed yourself. I find music is a very good stress reliever. They say lack of hope when you feel there's no way out of this stressful situation, but there is light at the end of the tunnel when you least expect. And then it goes on to speak about the sadness, the example that you gave regarding the person you knew that took their own life. Okay, let's see, we've got a couple of calls. Once I share the messages. Mental Health Matters, good afternoon.
Hello, good afternoon. How are you?
Go ahead, you're on.
I'm asking the doctor, who gave a doctor, any doctor or nurse, the authority to force medication on a person, whether it's injection or orals?
Right, so under the Mental Health Act in Barbados, someone can be treated in hospital if they pose a high risk to themselves or other people. And that's very clearly stated in the Act. So that is why when a patient is assessed, you need what we call the medical recommended patient, which is involuntary admission. You have two independent doctors who would do that assessment. And the idea is that the one doctor sees the person and makes their recommendation, and the second doctor then sees the person separately. And if both doctors determine that this person is a high risk of hurting themselves or high risk of hurting somebody else, then that person can be involuntarily admitted and treated then in hospital.
For a doctor
Go ahead, caller.
For a doctor to give a patient medication and not concerned with how you feed them with the medication.
Well, and, I think the patient should always be
saying to the patient, they have no right in the matter. They have no say in the matter of what they get in their bodies.
I think when making decisions about your body, you do have the right to be part of the discussion and the decision about medications being given. There would be some patients who, because they have not, they are not capable of making the decision based on some type of mental health disorder, where they cannot make the decision about need for medication. That's the time when two independent doctors would make that decision. But that does not describe the vast majority of patients who are using medication related to mental health conditions.
Question. I was a patient at the psychiatric hospital, and I was given medication, and the doctors refused to listen to me. And as a result of that, I could not even help myself, not even brush my teeth. After waiting in the hospital, feeling well, and when I left, I was not feeling well, and I attempted suicide more than once because of that reason. Going in well, and when I come out, I'm not well, and getting no more support from the family. Tell me if that could be right.
Right. So I think it's important that as much as possible, family members are involved with patient care, because it's a good support system there that is needed in understanding the reasons why a doctor may say that somebody needs to take medication, especially as in this situation here with this colleague saying she did not want to take it. And maybe what needed to happen there would be a discussion around what the alternatives are, because they're, you know, in terms of also recognizing what the consequences would be of not taking a particular medication or taking different options. So there's sounds to me that there's a lot of discussion that needs to happen there with this particular situation that the caller described.
Next caller.
Yes, good evening.
Go ahead.
Yes, doctor, can you please explain for me what is paranoid schizophrenia? If I pronounce it correctly.
Yes, paranoid schizophrenia.
Yes.
So schizophrenia, okay. Schizophrenia describes a number of syndromes, because every person's experience of it will not be the same. And therefore we think of it as a number of syndromes where someone can present with any number of symptoms, including, for example, hearing people talking when there's nobody around. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you can hear voices giving them commands, telling them what to do, or talking about what the person is doing. And that's very different to say when you have an example where sometimes you think somebody calls your name and then you answer, and somebody in the house say, oh, I didn't call you. That is not what we call schizophrenia. With hearing voices, it is a more complex experience. You may have one or two or multiple voices that occur often. In addition, people may have what we call delusions, where you feel or you believe that people are either trying to hurt you or plotting against you or want to do you harm in some way. Sometimes people with schizophrenia would also present with behaviors that seem unusual or odd, or thinking that seems unusual or odd. Sometimes people present with symptoms like what we call catatonic symptoms, where there's no real response. They're not responding to somebody talking to them or giving them directions, or they may stand in one spot and not move, what we call posturing. So there are a whole number of ways in which people can present. It's a condition in which you need to see these things happening for over 6 months consistently before you can come to that conclusion. So it's not something you diagnose having met somebody once or twice. You have to see the person over a period of time to come to that conclusion.
So when do you take this person to see a doctor? At this juncture, is it when you notice that they may be acting differently? Is this the time that you should take them to the psychiatric hospital or to C4 at the QEH?
Yes. So anytime there's a change in behavior, because remember earlier on I was saying that, you know, sometimes what you notice is that the person's behavior is different to what it used to be. Now, mm-hmm. a change in behavior in itself doesn't mean paranoid schizophrenia, because you can have changes in behavior for any number of, you know, thousands of reasons. The mm-hmm. point is you want to understand mm-hmm. what is happening so that you can intervene as early as possible. And by intervening, it may mean that the person just needs talk therapy for mm-hmm. a few weeks versus talk therapy and medication or whatever else. We don't know. But the point is you need to intervene as soon as possible.
So the person does not mean that every time that there is a situation that the person should go and be incarcerated at the hospital. It's best to talk to the individual if you can get through to them.
Right, that's where you start. And then you can have the assessment done after that.
I don't know if I like the word incarcerated. It might be restrained, but not incarcerated.
Yeah, but when you go to the psychiatric hospital, that is where you will be in a room locked away for a period of time. And when you go to the hospital first, that is the first place you go. You go in a little cell with a little bed, or maybe not, and you just look through some rails. So that's why we call it incarceration. What word would you use then?
Would you, Dr. Emmanuel, could you address that?
The assessment process at the hospital begins at the unit with the doctors on call. If they determine for whatever reason that this person is a risk to themselves or other people, that person is then held in a room, accommodated in a room by themselves. And maybe that's what this caller is talking about, being in a room by themselves. And that happens if it is assessed that the person's risk is high, whether it's, you know, suicide or to other people.
No, because I have a family member that I deal with on a day-to-day basis. And sometimes they do get angry. They probably just make a change quickly and say things that not making sense. Or when they're angry, things that they say, you may become a bit scared. So I just want to know how you go about when that particular situation occurs.
Okay, well, in that situation, if the person is acting in an aggressive way, mm-hmm. then the intervention would be to prevent harm to other people. So that's why the person would be in a room by themselves. Because you don't want to wait until the person injures somebody and then do something about it, right?
I am speaking... So that's why about the person being at home at the point in time, not necessarily at the psychiatric hospital. And then you may decide, well, look, this is time that I call the police to get assistance, and that may not always work. The person might get angry, and they might think that you are doing them something wrong when you're trying to help.
Yeah.
May I just say something? I've been in a situation once just to help the caller, and mm-hmm. I think it's important for the public to know this. Mm-hmm. I've been in a situation once where I was trying to help a family member mm-hmm. who refused to get into my car and proceeded to walk along the ABC highway at 9 o'clock at night. I picked up the phone, called the police. I explained the background of the individual mm-hmm. very carefully. I asked them to be gentle. I asked them not to utilize any force because of the person's mental health challenges. and they were amazing. I described what the individual looked like. And clearly there are some officers who are trained to deal with these matters. The individual sat in their car, and all I can tell you is that it was resolved very nicely, but I got help at that point in time from the Barbados Police Service.
Well, that may be the way to go then, but you know, when you have a person that people consider to be a mad person, as people put it, the stigma that is attached, you know, when you see these people, they're, you feel so hurt for them, because they're, sometimes there's not much that you can do for them. As the doctor rightfully said, maybe they might just need someone to talk to. But because you have not been trained to talk, sometimes then the only alternative is to get the police to come in to take them to the psychiatric hospital. And sometimes they are not fully off, but just that they need someone to talk to. And I feel, I'm going to go now, that instead of these people that are not mad, there should be a particular place where these people can go and just have a little time to relax by themselves, so that the stigma is not always there attached to these individuals. So thank you very much for listening, and do have a wonderful evening. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Thank you, ma'am.
Ronnie has given us a few more minutes, Dr. Emmanuel. I think that, wow, clearly people, there's a need to do more of this. I have a question for you, and it is this. The clash between wanting to be confidential, whether that is, well, with a minor, I think is different, but with an adult, there's something called duty of care. So you know someone is in crisis, you see the signs, the signals, the behaviors, you can't just ignore it. Whether this is in the workplace, at home, in a social setting. So I want you to address this whole issue of having a duty of care and confidentiality. And where do the two align?
Right. So a conversation between somebody and their mental health professional is confidential, but there are exceptions, as you would imagine. So if I or the professional determines that this person is a high risk of suicide, the information is no longer confidential, because I cannot have somebody saying to me, these are the things I've planned to do. When I go home at 5 o'clock, this is what I'm doing. And then tell them, oh, okay, we'll go along then. Obviously, that would be quite negligent on my part. So risk to self, there's high risk, I should say. Not every single time somebody says they're having those types of thoughts. If somebody says to me that they are abusing a minor in any way, meaning sexual, physical, or emotional abuse, I would not keep that in confidence either. And then if a court subpoenas my records for a patient, not just the police saying so-and-so, we think this person did X, why was this person coming to see you? That's not enough. The court actually has to subpoena the records, right? So those are three fairly high standards. So people have this sense, like sometimes when I'm involved with, say, custody cases, people have this sense that, well, because I'm seeing Dr. Emmanuel, my partner is going to go and get the notes and come and tell the judge that I am, you know, mad or whatever it is. It doesn't work like that. right? The information is yours. So unless you tell me I can give it to your partner or your ex-partner, I can't give it. The three times confidentiality is broken, or the three times I mentioned above, no other time.
So let me ask you something. Let's say I'm your patient. Mm-hmm. You have records about my mental health challenges, mm-hmm. but I commit a crime. Mm-hmm. And my lawyer wants to demonstrate that this is uncharacteristic. Mm-hmm. This is unusual behavior for Tessa. Mm-hmm. Are you saying to me then that you can share my notes with the court without my knowledge?
No. Either you give your lawyer that permission and then, in effect, giving me permission, or the judge in the case will have to say, will have to subpoena the notes. But the other person's lawyer can't just say, oh, I hear she's going to see Dr. Emmanuel.
Okay.
Go and get the notes from Dr. And I've had situations before where that kind of thing had been attempted. But I just wrote back to say, well, no, unless so-and-so gives me permission, I cannot disclose that information to you. And that was the end of that, because obviously the person is not going to give permission in that way. You
know? Yeah. We have another caller, and Ronnie has given us more time, but maybe this will be our last caller.
Yes, hello.
Hi, good afternoon.
Hey, good afternoon.
Welcome.
Yes, thank you. I'm glad for this discussion. I want to ask a question about cutting. Is this more within the realm of youth or all age groups?
So yes, self-harm by way of cutting tends to be among adolescents, especially females, but we do have some male patients who are presenting in that way. Mm-hmm. Typically the profile is it's a young lady, either being bullied in some way, because we're talking about, you know, adolescents here, or experiencing some type of violence. As I said, usually there's some alcohol or drug use. Usually there's maybe poor family dynamics or poor relationship with friends, that type of thing. So yes,
the short reason, answer to your question. Yeah, the reason I asked that question, you're still there?
Hello?
Yes,
we're here. Right. The reason I asked that question is because I did a nursing course in geriatrics, and they spoke about different reasons why people do these things and so on. So they also mentioned self-hate, unforgiveness, either on their part or they've done something and won't forgive themselves or somebody won't forgive them. Can you delve into that a little bit more? Because even like young girls who might run away and so on, say they're got entangled with an older adult or whatever, it is quite normal, as our tutor was saying, for a young woman to want to desire, you know, friendship and so on, but the society see her as too young and everything. And don't let us fool ourselves, sex is good, but yet we are telling them it's wrong, they're evil, they're wicked, they're running away, So, I mean, I think what Archie was saying is that these things bring on a lot of guilt, feelings, and they don't know how to handle it, and therefore, a lot of the other things, they get into cutting. So, yes, I'll listen to you. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. I think what tends to bring on guilt is the interaction between young people and older people, and typically it's young females with older males, which, yes, oftentimes one can call it abusive. Because if you take the example, say, of a 14, 15-year-old with a 25 or 30-year-old, there is no way that that interaction, let me call it interaction, is anything but abusive, right? So although the person may feel, the 14-year-old may feel that she is in a relationship, that is not a relationship that is based on equity or equality. You know, when you think of the emotional maturity or lack thereof of the typical, of the average 14-year-old versus that of a 25-year-old, you can understand there's a power divide that exists there between a 14 and a 25-year-old. That, you know, it one can see how that can be very much an abusive type of relationship. By law, a 14-year-old cannot consent to sex. And even starting with that, that is obviously problematic. So I think, you know, it's important to understand relationship dynamics from the point of view of age, level of maturity, what is legal, what is the ethical thing to do, and then understand how that plays out in how such a young person may then go on to cuts and self-harm in any number of ways.
Okay. Caller, is that, are you done? Or are there more questions for Dr. Emmanuel?
The caller left. The caller asked the question and then and then went.
Okay. All right. Well, I think we need to wrap this up. And clearly, we may need to have more discussion on this subject matter. If you would be so kind, Dr. Emmanuel, at another time. But next week is Dr. McLachlan, who is the senior consultant psychiatrist at the Barbados Psychiatric Hospital. Please note that I refrain from using words like Jenkins and the mental and BlackRock. We need to change our narrative, but it will be Dr. McLachlan. And Dr. Emmanuel, if you could just briefly tell us about the week of activities for the Barbados Association of Psychiatrists, please.
Yes. Okay, so it actually begins tonight at 8 o'clock, People's Business on CBC, where we're talking about the role of mental health specialists in navigating difficult times. So that's People's Business. Tomorrow on Instagram Live, we're talking about unlocking psychiatry and mental health, and that's at 6 p.m. If you go on Instagram and put in Barbados Association of Psychiatrists, you would see the page. Then on Wednesday evening at 6, we have a panel discussion for the public. We're talking about managing mental health and living in a pandemic. And we're going to have psychiatrists, occupational therapists, and psychologists having that panel discussion.
That's and by Zoom? That would be by Zoom?
Yes, that one is via Zoom. Okay. Again, if you go on our Facebook or on Instagram, you're going to get the link. And then we end the week on Saturday at 5 p.m. This is more for all mental health professionals. We're going to have the second annual George Mahey lecture, which will be done by Professor Hutchinson, who's a professor in psychiatry in Trinidad, UWE Trinidad. And he's talking about improving mental health, the essential Caribbean imperative. So all quite exciting topics. We're really looking forward to this week. And we invite everybody to come out and have a listen and to interact with us during these events. Thank you.
Yeah, the George Mahey lecture, I would assume, is also Zoom.
Yes, that's Zoom as well. And it's for the mental health professionals.
So
not on Wednesday is for the general public.
Okay, so the George Mahey lecture is not for the public.
Well, it's pitched at the level of the mental health professionals, but we're not going to turn anybody away. I mean, you have to register first because a lot of us need CME points, and so that would be one step.
Yeah, I mean that's something I'd really want to participate in.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Dr. Emmanuel, I want to thank you. Thank you. I appreciate all that you have shared with us. You have been very explicit in, defining and helping the public to understand the intricacies, the complexities of this subject matter. There's much more that I wanted to ask. But we may need to have another program to discuss this.
Sure.
I was thinking about, for example, communities like the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, the whole issue of being recognized as the other, you know, not heterosexual, coping with gender identity, sexual orientation, and being accepted. That is another, that throws up other issues where suicide is concerned.
Yes, it does.
Yeah. So Ronnie, thank you. I wish to thank once again Lewis Drug Mart for sponsoring this program and also next week's. And you can take it away with O Sole Mio by Pavarotti.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Emmanuel. Vielen, danke schön. Recording.
Oh!